Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO, a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, driving, gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 360, and it's proudly brought to you by the always growing TGN supporter crew. We thank you all so much for your continued support, and if you'd like to support the show, please visit thegreynato.com for more details. My name is Jason Heaton, and I'm joined as ever by my friend and co-host, James Stacey in Toronto. James, how are you doing? 360, that feels, I don't know, it's a kind of a nice number, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a big round number for sure. It's maybe the roundest number, depending on how you look at it. Yeah, I'm doing okay. You know, it's a weird time to be, you know, on the internet. You know, obviously you're local to a lot of sort of unrest in the States. How are things there? You doing okay?
Well, if I'm honest, not entirely okay. I mean, I'm based in Minneapolis for those that don't know. But it's, you know, if you follow the news at all, you'll know that we've had some pretty serious goings on here over the past week or two. Specifically last week, someone was shot not far from where I'm sitting, less than a mile. And there's a huge presence of, you know, what do we call them? You know, federal agents, I guess, all over here. And it's gotten scary. I mean, it feels, you know, as someone who exists largely on the safe side of things and remain largely unscathed, it's just been kind of a scary place to live and see what's going on, and knowing people that are affected has just been kind of rattling. I was out to lunch yesterday with some friends, and just a couple blocks away there was an intersection where these armored vehicles went straight through the intersection and were kind of lobbing tear gas canisters out in the street. I mean, these are the sorts of things that we don't usually think of happening in our home cities. And, you know, here Minneapolis has had a rough time since 2020. You know, we had some political assassinations last year, and then kind of the city burning back in the summer of 2020. And it's, we've said this before, we're not a political podcast and we don't wade into that fully, but I can't ignore what's going on here and just kind of admit that everything's a-okay when it's a little scary. And I just wanted to put that out there.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, there's some, certainly on my side, there's some privilege in that I have a great distance being in a different country, but man, it's definitely, it feels like the opening scenes of, like, you know, a disaster film.
Yeah.
You know, where they show clips from the news of, tear canisters and things on fire and doors being kicked in and that sort of thing. And it feels, incongruous with like growing up as a Canadian, what you learn about, you know, the foundational elements of the states and what they stand for.
Yeah.
The last several years feel outside of that scope. It's a tough thing to kind of contextualize. And like you said, we don't pretend to be, you know, overly political on the show. But look, we are considering, you know, like we did during 2020 and in the past, you know, supporting some local efforts for the population in and around where Jason lives. And if you have any suggestions of a great charity that could use a little bit of an infusion from the TGN crew, let us know on the Slack. We're kind of considering kind of weighing out the options. Maybe a cool supporter t-shirt or something like that would be a good idea.
Yeah.
We certainly, you know, have the tools in place to spin that up, but yeah, it's a tough time. And, you know, you and I have traded a handful of text messages and that sort of thing about how it's kind of, it feels just right outside your door.
Yeah.
I feel for you, man. I'm sorry. That's obviously that's a lot of pressure for that community and beyond.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. And, you know, I think our show is one that provides kind of a bit of a port in a storm and a bit of an escape for folks. And we're happy to do that. And I'm, again, we'll kind of leave it there and kind of move on here shortly. But I just wanted to kind of acknowledge what's happening and how I'm feeling, as we're all about transparency. And I think people appreciate that. And, you know, a lot of times what we talk about on the show feels a bit outside of kind of the real world, so to speak, or a bit escapist. And that's okay sometimes. And I think to provide that, I think, is something that we're happy to provide. So, you know, with that in mind, let's move on to kind of other news, I guess, in our own lives. What have you been up to lately?
Yeah, just trying to fill the void with it being dry January. You know, I kid. It actually hasn't been that tough. I'm sleeping really well.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it'd be hilarious to look back at like this episode last year and the episode the year before. I'm probably saying, oh, you know, it's a little boring, but I'm sleeping better and I feel pretty good and the exercises feel good and all that kind of thing. And that's all true. Trying to stick to a lot of the stuff we talked about on the past episode with our ins and outs. So back on the train with the Elro Industries Minifone Ultra, I put my phone down in my office Friday afternoon, like after work, or Friday evening after work. And I barely touched it except for a couple things where I had to like check for an Amazon package delivery timing, that sort of thing. Otherwise, I could just have the Elro in my pocket and I could get a text message. I could get a Slack if it was important. And otherwise, I was very much able to kind of segment what I feel is like kind of the most problematic small screen for me, which is like a phone, down to something that's much less useful in terms of like killing time. But great, just to grab a little bit of information. I still have my weather, I still have my podcast if I want to, if I'm, you know, washing the dishes or going for a quick walk or something like that. So that's great. Highly recommend whether you do it with the Minifone Ultra, which is my preference, or just wear a smartwatch or something like that that allows you to have a certain amount of connectivity, but not the type that feels kind of invasive or doom scrolly or that sort of thing.
Yeah. That's a great example of kind of technology solving a technology problem. You know, I mean, it's...
And I do think that we probably, maybe not in this year, who knows, but I am thinking that it won't take too long for the broader tech world. And I don't mean the smaller boutiques, whether it's an Elro Industries or the people who make some of the more simple style phones now, the dumb phones and that sort of thing. I mean, like Apple, Samsung offering sort of a paired device that keeps you in a piece of the ecosystem. And maybe for Apple, they think that's the Apple Watch. You have cellular on it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think this will be a kind of a growing thing. I wouldn't be surprised. Definitely you look at just Instagram for Ed Jelly's company, for Elro, and you see all that he's shipping. He's on to something, as are the two or three other people that seem to be making kind of a similar product. This ability to kind of really be able to control how much of your attention is going to one of these sorts of devices is nice. So that's been great for me. I've definitely traded my Instagram scrolling for reading. So I finished Perfection, which I spoke about on a previous episode. I enjoyed it. I don't know. I'll have to read more of the books from Anthony Jeselnik's list to decide if like where it would land for me. Sort of well outside of my normal. But enjoyed it. Very fast read, maybe 150 pages, something like that. And then I jumped into something much heavier in topic. Over the last little while, the last maybe like 2-3 months, I've been kind of more and more interested with like the triggers that bring countries closer to nuclear war. And both of my brothers, both Grant and Tim, two of my three brothers, had suggested Nuclear War, a Scenario by Annie Jacobson. And I kind of can't put it down. It's among the most macabre, downtrodden, you know, basically she's writing about what would happen by the minute from the moment that a nuclear missile was launched.
Yeah.
To, you know, I think I'm 40% of the way into the book. I'm maybe 45 minutes into the nuclear scenario and the world's almost over.
Yeah. Wow. Wow.
And I had a very low level of education about any of this, about the technology behind it, the difference between an atomic bomb and a hydrogen bomb, you know, the thermal nuclear weapon, the modern. And so I'm finding this book absolutely fascinating. And so, yeah, I'm working my way through that. It's not easy reading. It's pretty heavy.
Yeah.
And it paints a fairly up to date, like, you know, they're talking in terms of 2024. I highly recommend it if this is something that could be of interest. Like, I had no idea. It opens with something that I found jaw dropping. And Jason, if you haven't read the book, I'll ask what, because I think I don't know. I can't answer my own question. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So in the book, it proposes a scenario where North Korea fires an intercontinental ballistic missile at the U.S., at Washington.
Mm-hmm.
How long do you think it takes for the U.S. to know that that missile has been launched? I'll even give you a cheat. The missile is only really trackable in its first phase.
Yeah.
At least from a distance when it's still under power. So you have 5 minutes of rocket.
Oh, yeah.
Before it's essentially hurtling, and then it has to get picked up when it's over the U.S.
Oh, yeah.
So just for fun, so now you know it's less than 5 minutes to find to know that, like, before a signal is sent to somebody to say a rocket was just fired.
Yeah. Yeah.
Take a guess at how long that takes.
I don't know, 12 minutes?
Less than half a second.
Oh my gosh. Wow. So
the first alarm would go off 12 minutes. 12 minutes, they're into the phase where like the president would be deciding what the response is.
Well, as you're saying all this, I'm thinking of that show, the movie, A House of Dynamite. Was it based on this book by chance? Because it sounds very much like what you're describing.
I'm not sure. I know that the movie rights, I believe, went to Denny Villeneuve for this, but that could just be a thing I read on the internet.
Okay, because that movie was Catherine Bigelow, and it was quite good, and it was very frightening, and they kept kind of revisiting this scenario from different perspectives, and it was chilling. Wow, yeah, that book sounds amazing.
Yeah, so that's what I've been doing into that. And then, I spent the weekend, and again, it all kind of falls downstream of Ed and Elro Industries, which sounds like an ad, but I promise it isn't. I paid for it. I'm really happy with the product. I would buy it for anybody I know who has an Apple Watch that would fit it. But because of Ed, I also figured eventually I would try my hand at some 3D design.
Yeah, wow.
And, you know, I downloaded Fusion a while ago, and I think I sent you some photos. I was like, oh, I'll make a handle for a Yeti. Yeah. Just because it gave me a measurable thing.
Right, right.
A physical thing that I could measure.
Yeah.
And so I did that. It didn't go great. it was fine, you know, and it's a good time to, like, making prototypes and doing that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then Sarah sent me this thing from a company that makes, like, a milled metal channel that you put on your desk that holds those kind of cue cards that I write my to-do lists on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so it keeps it kind of upright and sitting on your desk, and you can kind of organize them. And I looked at that and I thought, well, I mean, their design's very beautiful and it's not super expensive, but I feel like I could make that for 20 cents. And so I started designing my own. We did 3 or 4 prototypes, and now Sarah and I each have them on our desks. And it's this little, you know, block of plastic, of PLA plastic, that's printed, that has like 2 channels for cue cards.
Yeah.
And you can put the cards in there. It's one of the channels can hold a pen if that's what you would rather. So I've got the CPN1 on there. And I had a blast just kind of learning a little bit. And there's a couple YouTube videos I watched to figure out how to, like, start. Basically, you sketch at least one side of it in 3D and then extrude it in other directions, which is quite exciting. And then, thankfully, my brother Grant is also into 3D printing and has gone way deeper into, like, creating and modeling his own things.
Yeah.
So if I got stuck, I could give him a ring and kind of share my screen, and he would walk me through some of it. So I'm absolutely enjoying that. I need to find my next sort of problem in my life to solve with a 3D printer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That was my weekend. It was a lot of that. My daughters and I and Sarah are playing a lot of Animal Crossing. We reset our island. So if you're an Animal Crossing nerd, you'll know what that means. We had started one back in probably 2020 during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And then, you know, stopped playing a few years ago and just figured now might be an okay time. You know, this is kind of the coldest, dreariest season in the next couple of months. You know, we don't spend as much time outside and that sort of thing. Yeah. But this allows us to do stuff that's kind of together and a little bit less, again, on the phone, on the small screen, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it is. It is a tough time of year to kind of, you know, if you're feeling antsy and you're trying to stay off screens and you're trying to stay off alcohol, like, it is kind of the worst month for both. I mean, it's, you know, it's tempting to kind of just, you know, go into your cave and have a whiskey and, you know, binge watch a show and buy a bunch of stuff online and whatever else. But, it's, you know, here it's, we've had this sort of roller coaster of temperatures and whatnot, and it's been sort of, up and down and very, icy and then it's slushy and back and forth. So the dog walks have been very interesting. I've been wearing cleated ice bug shoes
for a lot
of that. Yeah. But nothing too exciting here. Other than the fact that I kind of furthered my watch purge last week. I sold 4 watches. There's still a fifth on the BST as we're recording this, and it just feels good. I feel lighter already, you know. I mean, it was nice, and I'm seeing them popping up on the wrists of the new owners on Slack, and, you know, I appreciate their easy transactions, and it's always a joy to work on the Slack, you know, selling stuff as opposed to kind of the other methods, the kind of grim back and forth you get on the forums and whatnot. So it's been good. And I'm just glad to see some watches going to homes that where they'll be appreciated and
for sure.
Also lighten my load, you know, clear out my box a little bit.
Yeah. I'm down 4.
Yeah.
For the year, all stuff that I like quite a bit, but wasn't wearing. So it's going to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm more happy. I'm happy I sold one. I'm, of course, or sold a few. I'm happy that you did as well. I'm more happy that I haven't bought any.
Yeah.
That feels like a win for me so far. You know, the only thing I've bought so far this year is some PLA for the printer.
that's great. We're 13 days into the year.
We're doing okay.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, for sure. Well, look, how about we get into a little bit of wrist check, and then we get to carry on carry the torch of the Q&A into 2026 from last year's many great questions. I'm actually pretty pumped because some of these were pretty fun questions. So
yeah.
Why don't we buzz through a quick wrist check? It looks like we're both rocking the same thing.
Yeah, I've got the Crew Watch number one, our CWC collaboration from about this time last year. I've been wearing the FXD kind of nonstop, and this one isn't far from that kind of form factor. But you know, it's great to pick it up and have the, have that super lightweight and the accuracy. It's running, it's set to the second pretty much because of that great movement that's in here. And I did move it onto the rubber NATO, that Benetto Centurini Zulu Diver rubber NATO. I've got the olive drab one. It's a perfect fit for this watch. And you know, the fun little part about this strap is that it's got that vanilla scent to it that just doesn't go away. And some people don't like that, but if I even move my arm a little bit, like this little bit of aroma kind of wafts up, and it's this, mm-hmm. it's an element of watch ownership that you don't normally get. You know, I mean, watches don't have a smell component. They have sound, they have sight, they have feel. Smell is usually not a sense you're using with your watch, but
ideally,
ideally, right. So that's been fun, and it sounds like you're wearing the same.
I'm wearing the same CWN1. I absolutely just, you know, what is there left to say? I'm wearing my CWN1. I love it. I've got it on the leather NATO that Chaz made for me, which has become an absolute favorite. It just kind of matches everything. Obviously, in the middle of January, I'm not worried about either getting it drenched in sweat or going swimming or diving. Mm-hmm. So a leather NATO on even a dive-ish style watch like this one doesn't bother me. I would feel differently if I was going to be, like I said, sweating, taking it to the cottage, that sort of thing. I'd put it on a normal NATO or the rubber for sure. It is really good on the rubber NATO.
Yeah.
And I've been very tempted by that Anchor rubber one with the nicer clasp and that mm-hmm. sort of thing. I just haven't pulled the trigger.
Yeah.
But Instagram has me, when I do open it, I get that ad a lot.
Yeah.
And I believe it's on the CWC, their dive version of this same watch.
Yeah, I've seen that ad. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
So every now and then I kind of catch them and I go, hey, did they? No, it's the other one.
Yeah.
So that's fun. But yeah, CWN1 for both of us. I think it's going to be a year where this continues to just get a huge amount of wear. And in many ways kind of makes a lot of my other sort of loosely similar or watches you'd pick up and have to set every day mm-hmm. much less appealing.
Yeah.
I'm really treating this like a G-Shock or even a Timex, where I'm just kind of throwing it on because I know it's already set.
Yeah.
And I picked it up today and I was like, let's just double check. And it was like within as close as I could measure to a second.
Yeah.
Given that I have to look at the seconds hand and then look at the number on my phone.
Oh, yeah.
It's close enough.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
We're never going to be quite dead on. But yeah, I'm super happy with it. So yeah, let's jump into the main topic, which is a continuation of 2025's Q&A. What's the fast? Did we ever find a fast way to explain this? If this happens to be your first Q&A, welcome to the show. We're very happy to have you here. I will try to be as quickly as possible with this explanation. Q&A is a text-based question chain from our Slack, which is behind the paywall. But normally we do our monthly Q&A, which is an audio-based show where you send in a voice note. And some people don't want to send in voice notes. It also kind of removes the ability for it to be like a communal experience. So we started collecting, and I think this list was probably like 70 to 80 questions, and we're moving our way through that. But we started collecting them on an annual basis, and we just didn't get to all these questions. So if you're listening and you're not part of the Slack, you're not part of the supporter crew, no big deal there. But if you'd like to be part of it and get into question and answer and threads kind of similar to this, that's the Q&A. And this is part 7 from our 2025 chunk of questions. And we'll kick it off with one, a bit of a longer one from Jonathan Zalamea.
And he's got a question about IWC Big Pilot. So he says, one of the watches that got me into the hobby was the IWC Big Pilot owned by John Mayer. His love for the watch, along with his stories while on tour, showed me that watches were more than just timekeeping instruments. As I went along my watch journey, learning about more history behind watches like the Speedmaster and the Moon or the Hamilton Khaki Field and American Military, I realized the origins of the Big Pilot and the German Air Force during World War II. Ever since then, I've had conflicting feelings. On the one hand, it was my first true watch obsession. On the other, I don't really like military history. I haven't heard of many others within the watch community feeling this way, so I'm wondering what your thoughts are about watches with more complicated origins. Has this affected any purchase decisions for you in the past? Would this type of tie-in prevent you from buying the watch if you were in my position? You know, this one's come up. I've pondered this a few times over the years, and it does come up on forums with some frequency. What's your take on this? I don't think we've ever discussed it.
You have to decide how far you want to zoom out, right? Because this is going to affect a lot of German product.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to sit here and have any moral superiority in this world. I talk about Porsche. I like their cars. If you go far enough back in that family tree, Ferdinand Porsche was very close to Hitler.
Yeah.
And that also led to Hitler's car brand. I'm making this a simplification, but I don't believe we would have Volkswagen without the impetus from Hitler to make that brand.
Yeah.
But then let's be clear, what happened about 25, 30 years later? It became the symbol of the American hippie movement.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Context for products changes over time. You know, I've talked to people before who like wouldn't buy a Volkswagen because of their Jewish heritage, but are driving a Ford.
Mm-hmm.
Where Henry Ford was openly anti-Semitic and an admirer of the Third Reich.
Yeah.
I think this is an incredibly complicated thing, and it largely because watches aren't needed. You get to decide how much it does or doesn't bother you. I don't believe like, and the difference is what's today's context. I genuinely don't believe, having met some people, including people who lead IWC, that they have any vestigial connection to that origin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are exceptions. There are brands that survived in opposition, like Leica.
Yeah.
You look back at the history of Leica. I've been to the Leica house in Wetzlar, where they hid all sorts of people that they were trying to get out of country.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating, you know, underpinning to the original elements of that brand. But that's not the way it's going to work for everyone, especially not engineering and manufacturing firms. Things like vehicles, planes, timing equipment. This is always going to be complicated because, you know, watches really kicked off right after that.
Yeah.
Like the idea, a lot of the watches that we love and support and the Rolex, the Blancpains, the this, the that, those, that was all early 50s. Mm-hmm. Is when that really dialed up.
Yeah.
And over the next 15 years became like the icons that are largely still being referred to today. I do think it's complicated. I think it's complicated for people who want to collect Lange. I think it's complicated for, you know, if you wanted to get into vintage examples of those watches, you get closer and closer to that original connection. But we buy watches for emotional reasons, and those reasons will be full of dissonance.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think if IWC or any other brand's connection to World War II Germany bothers you, I would say go for another brand. But again, zoom out a little bit more. Does it bother you that Switzerland remained neutral in the face of the Third Reich?
Yeah, yeah.
There's this kind of never-ending spiral of complexity. And I would say if it bothers you, just don't buy their watches. That's fine, of course. It's a very personal watch, personal decision, what you buy or don't buy,
yeah,
based on reasons of the storytelling behind the brand. And of course, they're going to ignore that storytelling like every other brand will. It's a very ugly part of history.
Mm-hmm.
You have to decide what the current day context is for that product and how much of its legacy is still tied to that era. And with something like the Big Pilot, its aesthetic is directly derived from that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I could see how that could bother someone for sure. But it's also the kind of thing where like the more I talk, the more I'm just talking in circles, because I don't think that there's like a hard cut answer to something like this. It's largely what is your comfort zone? Does that bother you? I don't think it's wrong for it to bother you, but I also think the context for these things has changed multiple times over since that time.
Yeah, I think, you know, you've said most of how I feel as well. And I just think, for me personally, I've been entirely inconsistent on the topic. So for me to kind of come down and make a statement about the Big Pilot, which is a watch that I like the design. I get it. It's a cool watch, but I can't get past how it is. It's a direct mm-hmm. homage to or you know, modernization of a watch that was worn by Luftwaffe pilots. That said, I like Panerai's. Panerai was worn by Italian commandos, you know, blowing up British ships and whatever else. Helmut Sinn apparently was a trainer for Luftwaffe pilots during World War II. You know, so it's, you know, Stoa, you know, you can go on and on. But history mm-hmm. moves on and countries, you know, kind of reinvent themselves and it's all the things you said. So even though I avoid the big pilot, I still have a Zinn and I would still potentially consider a Panerai if the right one came along. But I think what bothers me maybe a bit more isn't the watch itself. And you can avoid buying a watch that nobody's holding a gun to your head and telling you to buy a certain watch, but it's a lot of the marketing and the branding and the photography and all that sort of stuff that goes around it, that it's almost an absence of acknowledgement. I'm not saying there needs to be an apology or any kind of direct acknowledgement, but this almost whitewashing of, you know, Panerai does it a lot where they have these, you know, photos of these divers, these kind of grainy old photos. And I think the way that they present it is in this very neutral way that, you know, these guys were wearing these watches, these brave people. And it's like, well, these brave people doing what? Or, you know, there's no mention in IWC's kind of marketing around the big pilot sure. about what they're all about. And I just feel like if there was a little more, I don't know how they would do it. I mean, that would be up to them. I'm not going to take that on. But I think that's the more troubling part of it for me. Yeah, it's a really complicated issue. And I think if you're going to come down on the side of, you know, total boycott of any of these, you're going to be, your list of brands is going to be very long and you'll be surprised by some of the brands that are on that list if you really do your research.
At what point do you say, I don't like any of the military history, which is something Jonathan said, I don't like the military history,
mm-hmm.
which is a totally fair perspective,
yeah.
but is going to limit the watches that you can, you know, kind of pick from.
Yeah.
Because so much of this is derived or now kind of meaninglessly connected to Top Gun, the movie. They didn't even wear a Top Gun front. I don't even see they wore the Porsche design.
Yeah.
It just becomes more complicated, more murky, more, you know, geopolitical. And I think, yeah, I can understand if you go, I don't want to have any part in this. And you know, do you start to consider not just a watch made for a given military outfit, but a watch worn by a political leader, despot,
mm-hmm.
you know, mercenary or dictator, because that's a tough look
mm-hmm.
for a lot mm-hmm. of brands, including brands that don't have the World War II history. Think of all the evil people that have been photographed wearing a Rolex.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if not evil, then just politically very complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And look, I think it's a fraught question. And if you think you have a really simple, straightforward answer for navigating it, I'd love to hear it for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think the reason most people, brands, Jason and I, don't approach it head on is because it's not a clear cut sort of direct statement. And that context could change with the scenario around the world at any moment.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much, Jonathan, for kicking things off with a thought-provoking question. We appreciate that.
Next up, we've got one from Dan Z, who's got a question about James Bond. He says, I personally love Timothy Dalton as Bond. It feels like he does not get the respect he deserves for his two films. What is your opinion on Dalton as 007? All right, Jason, you're more of the like hardcore Bond. Like, I obviously am a fan, but I think you extend into more of a scholarly aspect. What's your feeling on Dalton? It was what, that's 87 and 89, his two movies?
Yeah, The Living Daylights and then License to Kill. You know, I think I really like Timothy Dalton, and I think maybe part of that is, you know, everybody likes an underdog, and he's like the underdog Bond, and yet he was, at the time that he was Bond, was kind of a transitional period for that whole franchise, and he kind of missed out on what could have been a bigger run, a longer run, maybe some better films. I think Living Daylights and License to Kill were fun watches like any Bond films. I think they stand up fairly well. I think they're better than some of the later Roger Moore stuff like Moonraker, which is a pretty terrible film, if I'm honest. I know some people like the camp, but mm-hmm. I think they kind of rebooted things with Dalton, and he became the more serious, gritty Bond of the era, and it kind of fit with the times. And I think it was the model that they followed with Daniel Craig. And you know, Brosnan totally. Came in between, and Brosnan was kind of a more glib, polished, suave person or character. And I think Dalton maybe was a little bit premature in the casting. He's a great actor, a classically trained actor. He's got a great voice. I think he had the right look, and his delivery of the lines was good. I think the era in which his films were made, it was a bit of a bland time, kind of fashion or style wise. And I think if you go back and watch some of the movies, some of the clothes, you know, kind of the baggy Miami Vice style suits and the hairstyles and things just make me cringe a little bit. That was kind of my, you know, early adulthood period. And I kind of cringe and look back with some chagrin at that. But other than that, I like him. I think, you know, the Living Daylights was actually a fairly fairly faithful kind of translation of a short story that Ian Fleming wrote that had some of the same elements that I kind of appreciated. And The License to Kill, you know, set in Florida with the kind of the drug dealer thing, felt a little over the top, a little too close to a Miami Vice kind of ripoff. But Dalton himself was great. And I think if he'd had a couple more films, I think he'd go down as a far more loved 007. So that's my take. I think he's great, and I wish he had had more films in him.
Yeah, I've seen both of these. I do like him quite a bit. I think he was a great Bond. I think he was just maybe 7 or 8 years early.
Yeah,
to the timing. You know, Brosnan, not my favorite Bond, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
I love the first Brosnan film,
yeah.
GoldenEye, is great. But GoldenEye, to be fair, I went back and double-checked this, GoldenEye grossed more than both of Dalton's movies together.
Wow.
And I don't think that's because Brosnan was a better Bond or because that movie was an exceptional Bond film. It's good. It's a very good Bond film, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it's timing. That movie came after the first Mission Impossible. It also had the support of the Nintendo 64 in the video game, which I think gave the GoldenEye world a much stronger base among people who maybe that was their first Bond.
Mm-hmm.
Younger viewers, even children who weren't watching Bonds, were playing. Like I don't think I had seen a James Bond when I had already played hundreds of games of four-player split screen in GoldenEye mm-hmm. on the N64. Like you said, Jason, I think that the Daniel Craig scope of Bond owes a lot to Dalton. They're a little darker. They're shot more like proper auteur style films
mm-hmm.
rather than these kind of brightly lit, perfect hair, you know, shiny motorcycle sort of things that we saw with Brosnan. Again, just a different take. They were a little bit less tech heavy. The fashion didn't age as well. But yeah, it was also the first Bond, I went back and checked this as well, the first Bond that had to kind of deal with a PG-13 rating, which apparently changed the scope a little bit in the late 80s. I can't corroborate this as I didn't do a ton of research into the sociological elements at the time, but apparently there was more of a moral panic thing going on.
Hmm.
So the focus on movie ratings was much more tied to their success. Ours were a big problem. Unless you had, you know, certain people and the right elements, you know, and I don't know if any Bond has ever been an R. It would kind of surprise me if so. But yeah, I think just poor timing for an otherwise pretty solid sort of treatment of the Bond, and one that feels for me much closer to the books than the Brosnan Bond.
Yeah, good question. Always love a Bond question, and thanks for that one, Dan Z.
Yeah.
Next up, we've got one from Steve M., who has a two-part question. If you could go back in time and participate in an iconic adventure, Everest with Hilary and Norgay, North and South Pole, Endurance, etc., what would it be? And then if you get to time travel with one watch from your collection today, what would you take? James, where are you headed with this one?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure what was meant by the second question, but maybe you can fill me in on that. With the first one, I thought about this quite a bit. I don't know that I want to do Everest. Endurance sounded pretty tough. I read
yeah, Alfred right.
Brunson's book. I'm not sure I would, you know. But for me, it was, could you just put me on the boat for Blue Water, White Death?
Oh, that's so funny you would say that. Yeah. I was thinking.
Is that what
same.
You picked?
Well, it's close, yeah. Actually. But yeah, it was in my top two. Yeah.
Yeah. I would say, like, let me be a cameraman or a producer.
Yeah.
Or a sound guy or something for Blue Water, White Death. Let me tag along.
That'd be great.
And be part of that sort of an adventure. As much as I respect the Hilary Norgay, the North South Pole expeditions, Endurance, it's amazing. I don't want to be part of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Most of it sounds pretty terrible to a certain extent, yeah, especially right. when you're talking about endurance.
Yeah, right.
What those men went through.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think it would be like Blue Water White Death, or maybe put me on the production team for a Cousteau film, yeah. something like that.
Yeah, I think that general vibe is similar. I mean, I think it's that idea of kind of a rollicking adventure where you're together with a team. You know, there's the folk singer on board, and there's kind of, you know, some time on deck having a beer, and then suiting up and doing something kind of new and adventurous. That's great. So yeah, Blue Water White Death, the making of that film was up there. And related to that, I guess another one that I came up with was also Peter Gimble related, the guy who put together Blue Water White Death. In 1956, he was the first person to dive the Andrea Doria.
Oh yeah.
Like, I believe it was
the day
after it sank. Well, that was later when he went after the safe, but the first dive was the day after it sank. This is 1956, so it was pretty primitive dive gear. I mean, I think it was a single tank, you know, old Aqualung, you know, way offshore, no GPS. Like, they found an oil slick and figured this, here's where the wreck is. And he dove down, you know, 250 some feet, snapped a photo of like a lifeboat or something, or found a suitcase or whatever, and basically touched the wreck and came back up. And I don't know, that always kind of struck me as like a really brave endeavor. And I'm not sure that I would want to be, you know, again, kind of like you with, you know, with the endurance expedition. It doesn't exactly sound like fun. It sounds like a proper adventure. But I think Blue Water White Death was also kind of my top pick as well. And I think the second part of Steve's question is about, like, if you were to be able to take one of your current watches and go back to do this adventure, which one would you wear? And for me, I think, with an adventure like this, it's got to be the Submariner. I mean, it has to be. Or a Doxa. You know, both in Blue Water White Death, you get Stan Waterman, at least in some of the photos in the book Blue Meridian, wearing an orange dialed black lung Doxa. But you watch the film, and like, there's just a ton of Submariners on wrists. And I think that would just be a really fitting choice. So that's what I would take.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, the only wrench I would throw in with that context, you get to travel back in time to the exploration thing that we're picking.
Yeah.
And wear a watch. Yeah, I would probably either. Yeah, let me take my 50th anniversary Sea Rambler so that I fit in, or let me wear something that, like, they, people look back and go, what is that watch? And it, you know, in that case, you know,
the photos.
Let me wear my Pelagos 39
because
it would fly under the radar, sort of. But then, you know, imagine somebody looking back at like a grainy photo, and the cameraman is me, and he's holding up a, you know, an old camera, and on his wrist, you know, focusing the as he focuses the lens, is this watch that didn't exist. That would be kind of fun.
Yeah,
you know, kind of throw around. But who knows what would happen to, you know, with the bootstrap theory and that sort of thing, butterflies wings and such. But
I love the idea of somebody, you know, you going back in time, and it, I feel like there's been a movie about that or something, you know, where you see this photo and it's like, that's a modern watch in that photo. What is that thing?
Yeah, like Ben Affleck and Argo.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah, right. With his modern Submariner. That's that's egregious.
All right. Thanks so much for that one, Steve. Fun question for sure. Next up, we've got one from Dave N, who asks, if you get the chance for some personal travel this year, what's on the list? What's on your list, Jason? Anywhere you want to get to?
Personal travel. I mean, I think for you, it's probably you're going to have a lot of work travel. I mean, Watches and Wonders, of course, and other stuff like that. But personal travel, I've been light the past couple of years, and I think it'll continue. Just trying to fly a little bit less and do more regional kind of. I've got this kind of big swim I signed up for in August that's up in Lake Superior, so I'll be up there for a few days. Love to do more camping this year. Get some Great Lakes dives in. I missed out on that last year, so I need to do that. In terms of kind of more far-flung adventures, I did get an invitation recently to do some kind of an adventurous dive getaway out on the California coast in late April. So I'm considering that. Stay tuned. We'll see if that comes together for me. And then in May, Christy and I are really seriously cooking up a trip to Iceland, and we're planning on going and doing some hiking and hot springs, bathing, and I'd love to kind of tick off the longtime bucket list item of diving in Silfra, that really clear water that's between the North American and European tectonic plates. So that might be in mid-May.
Wow. Okay.
But that's, I mean, that's enough. You know, that's a good year, even if I tick off a few of those things.
So. Yeah, for sure.
How about you? Any travel beyond the kind of work stuff that's on the docket?
No, I mean, the next little while for work is Japan.
Oh, wow.
New York, Switzerland. And that takes me to the end of February.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like, ideally, I'd kind of hoped, and I'm sure I'm on record talking about it on the show, I'd kind of hoped to do the Tour de Mont Blanc for my 40th.
Oh, yeah.
Which is not that far away, a couple months out. But, you know, with that was before taking on the EIC role with Hodinkee and also before having a young child. So I think that's unfeasible, given the current scenario. I would say, you know, if I get some time off this year for vacation, I'd probably go to the cottage. And if I'm not going to the cottage or it's not that season, then, you know, I'd want to go somewhere where Sarah and I could get some dives in.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'd go somewhere where it's easy. You know, Cozumel is a great choice. There's spots we've been to before. We already kind of have the lay of the land and we like the diving and that sort of thing. So that would probably be the most of it. You know, my daughters have expressed some interest in more camping.
Mm.
So whether we do that, you know, on the cottage property where we have lots of open space and that sort of thing, or, you know, take them to some campsites further flung, you know, there's lots of that kind of stuff. But as far as like real travel just for the heck of it, at this point, I travel so much for work. And then with, you know, my son being not that old, it would probably just choose to either stay here or, you know, do something, you know, more car based in terms of some travel. I'm sure we'll get down to PA sometime this year, once or twice and that sort of thing. So I'm sure it'll end up being pretty busy, but no plans for travel given sort of the mix of the current workload and the family responsibilities.
Sounds good. Sounds like you got enough work travel anyway. So
yeah, I think I'll be good. Okay.
All right, we got time for one more here from Dustin, who says, what are your favorite watches that you'd never own? Perhaps they don't fit your personal style, budget, or durability, but you're really glad they exist and love seeing them. This is an interesting one. How about you? I think we've kind of touched on a few of these in the past.
Yeah,
you know,
this idea
of being able to appreciate a watch without not actually owning it. This is a little bit of a twist on that, but what springs to mind for you?
Yeah, I mean, the ones that jump to mind that are like, that people love, and that I understand the love of, but I don't actually feel it. Like I don't have it for me. I guess that would be, doesn't fit my personal style or what I like in watches. You know, that'd be the Daytona, the Speedmaster, you know, these like really well-known chronographs. They just don't speak to me. The Speedmaster has never really felt like it fit on my wrist. I've bored old ones. I've bored new ones. I've had lots of experiences. They're great watches, all that kind of thing. And then with the Daytona, I find them kind of hard to read.
Mm.
And also they represent this, like the original hype watch of our era.
Yeah.
You know, they were hard to buy when you could buy almost anything. And yeah, I don't have not something that I, you know, I like them. I understand what's great about them. I understand the incredible history and all that, but it's not a watch that I would buy and wear.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to like durability, I mean, most dress watches I like, you could, and even ones I don't like.
Yeah.
Like would make this list. Like I absolutely adore things like the Cartier Crash.
Mm-hmm.
Would look ridiculous on me. I like the Cartier Tanko Guichet. Less ridiculous on me, but also like just not a watch that suits the way that I wear watches. I have a couple of dress watches. I always end up kind of treating them like they're these precious things, and then I end up not really enjoying the experience of wearing them, or I'm worried about, you know, with my vintage ones, I'm worried about humidity and what's the temperature outside and all this kind of thing. So there's that. And then, man, when you get to budget, it's a really long list when you get to budget. I like the Chanel J12.
Mm.
Cool watch. Interesting design that wouldn't suit my style, out of my budget. Yellow gold GMT Master 2, the current one.
Mm.
Exceptionally cool watch. Doesn't suit my budget. Would look kind of hilarious on me. Like, could you imagine me showing up to like a wind-up hangout or something with a $40,000+, you know, yellow gold GMT Master. They're very cool. Yeah, the like, I'm interested in it, but don't have the money and won't.
Yeah.
And wouldn't if I did. You know, wouldn't buy it if I did. That list is exceptionally long. How about you? What about watches that you genuinely like but aren't for you?
Well, I remember, you know, years and years ago when I was just getting into watches, and my first press trip, strangely, was to Lange in Glashütte. And it just spoiled me. And I remember thinking, that's the watch I'm going to get when I'm 50 years old. I'm going to get the most affordable Lange. you know.
Sure.
That's changed. I don't have a desire to get a Lange. It's a watch. I'm glad they exist. Any Lange. I'm not talking a specific one, but I don't want one anymore. You know, I just don't. I don't feel like I need one in my collection. But I love that they exist. The same thing with the Reverso. It would look silly on my wrist. I don't see myself wearing one. That doesn't suit my lifestyle, my budget. I wouldn't wear it very often. But they're cool. They're fiddly. They're little kind of fidget spinners. They're beautifully designed. They're iconic. They're extremely well made from a great brand. But yeah, definitely not. Definitely not in the cards for me, but I'm glad they exist. I love seeing them whenever someone's wearing one. So, yeah, I think
that's a great pick for sure.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, there's just so many, like, you know, Pateks at large, Vacherons at large, Langes at large. Love that they're there. I love the chance to experience them. There's a world in which everything goes really well for your boy James, and I end up with a Lange 1 someday.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's a real world. It might be a parallel world to the one I'm experiencing now. I wore a very modern, like a 2025 Lange 1 a couple weeks back.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a perfect thing.
Yeah.
Like as a product.
Yeah.
The experience, the way it sits my wrist, it's incredible. But, you know, they're like, you know, whatever, 50 grand or something.
Yeah, right.
Like the number doesn't matter. You could say it's 20. It's still like that doesn't really move the needle for me.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's where I kind of land on that one. That's a fun question for sure.
Yeah.
Dustin, thank you so much for that. And yeah, I think just to keep us on schedule for the day, we both have some stuff to get to. We should probably jump into some final notes.
Yeah. I've got a pretty quick one, and that's actually a recent thing. Christy just got a new phone and she ordered a new case for it. There was a 2-for-1 deal actually from this company called Pela or Pela. It's P-E-L-A. These are phone cases made from a biodegradable material. I believe it comes from flax, and they're used in surprising things. I guess they're used in some insulation and building products and whatever. And this company has, they've made it kind of their mission to bypass the use of plastics in phone cases. And so they make them out of this this flax derived kind of hard material. And so yeah, we each ordered one, and so far so good. You know, we'll see about the durability and whether getting it wet just causes it to suddenly biodegrade in my pocket, which I doubt, obviously. That's a joke. But they've got a number of kind of cool designs. A little bit expensive, I guess, but worth it if you're kind of trying to stay away from plastic and something that, you know, you might just have for a few years before your phone goes obsolete. So yeah, check it out. Pela. I hadn't heard of them before, but it's a neat option.
Canadian company
in the field for it. Yeah, it's Canadian, right. Yeah.
Based in British Columbia. Yeah, yeah. Very cool.
Yeah. All right. What do you got?
Yeah. Mine this week is actually a twofer that both kind of connects into the company Discommon, who I'm sure we've spoken about on the show in the past. The first is a video from our good buddy, Henry Catchpole. He gets to drive Neil from Discommon, has this insane kind of kit car based on the style of a 1960s F1 car, the SV F1 Eagle. It's single seater open wheel. He has it plated so he can drive it. And, you know, I've seen this on his Instagram before. I don't think I've come across as complete a video, both covering like what Discommon and Neil are into and how that extended into the car. But then Henry driving this totally wild car.
Hmm.
You know, there's a side of me like I understand that in the real world, this is a sixth or a seventh car. Maybe if you're Neil, shout out Neil. We've traded some DMs on Instagram and that sort of thing. But maybe if you're Neil, it's a second car, which is rad. And that's the type of person I would aspire to be.
Yeah.
But just an absolutely incredible video. It's Henry at its best. It gives you a cool rundown of Discommon and some of his neat projects and all that sort of stuff. And then interestingly, it gives me a chance to talk about another thing, which is this product they have called the Puck, which is it's the most buy once, cry once take on the idea of like a zippered watch case.
Oh, sure.
So, you know, those like EVA foam cases, or what was the Oakley one called? The Vault, maybe?
The Vault, yeah.
So imagine that, but then take it to the nth, you know, the Discommon degree. So it's $205. I think I've bought the standard, you know, AliExpress ones for less than $20 to my door.
Yeah.
This case used to be known as the Archive, and then now they're selling it as the Puck. And it's it's the nicest thing that I put a watch in. It's nicer than most of the watches that go in it in terms of all of the considerations. I've been traveling with it for a little while. To be clear, Discommon sent me one to check it out, so I didn't pay for it. This isn't an ad. They didn't ask me to talk about it. They simply said, hey, you know, you're a guy who could probably appreciate this and give it a try. So I want to be on the line with that one. But it's like I said, just kind of the most over-engineered, complete, nice spec of this idea. And if you're looking for that buy once, cry once, or if you're looking for something, you know, with these ones that don't cost that much, I've bought them like 6-7 at a time. And then when I'm selling a watch or something, I'll put a watch in that, zip it up, put it in the box and ship it like that.
Yeah.
It's nice and easy.
Yeah.
I mean, this is Napa leather. Obviously, you know, you have compression molded foam padding on the inside for extra protection. Microfiber lining, you know, it comes in a couple different colors. I've got the black one with like a bright blue interior. It's really the nicest version of something that I know in kind of all the strata from the ones that are less expensive. We, you know, I think we've talked about the Vario SG ones on the show before, which I think are $20 to $30. I've had ones from brands that are kind of the one step up, and I think compared to those, this would be, you know, if you really wanted one and you wanted just one, or you've got other Discommon gear, I think it would fit in kind of nicely into that ecosystem. And it's just a really, really nice thing. And I think I wanted a chance to a natural opportunity to bring up the puck, and then seeing Henry's video, I thought, well, there's our twofer to close out the final notes.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, that's a cool product. I'd love to check one of those out.
Yeah.
Well, I've got an electrician waiting to shut the power off here, so without further ado, thanks everyone for listening. If you want to subscribe to the show notes, get into the comments for each episode, or consider supporting the show directly, and maybe even grab a new TGN signed NATO, please visit thegraynato.com. Music throughout a siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from Mark Parker of Nike, who says, "Curiosity is life, assumption is death."